Brother Jeff. Good morning, my dear brothers and sisters and young people. The thoughts of this exhortation are sort of taken from really the Psalms at the moment, and also the readings we've been doing in the Exodus. So I'll begin the exhortation with a question that you can think about and we'll consider as part of our theme this morning. And the question is, what is it in your life that is a sign that God is at work? What sign do you see in your life that God is with you and active in your life? Every single day the Israelites would get up on their journey to the promised land and they would see the pillar of cloud, God's specific sign that he was there amongst them. For a while, I suppose it would be absolutely miraculous, this cloud that would turn to a column of fire, a pillar of fire at night time. But as the months and years went by, the danger would be that this miraculous sign that God was there would be just another cloud. The miraculous was now just another day. But every day, God's intention is that he wants to see, wants us to see that he is at work in us. And we don't want to let his provision become commonplace in our lives. And it was the same with the manna. Every morning for the 6 days of the week, as they woke up, there was the manna on the ground. But again, after months and years of manna on the ground, for some it became a real wearisome and much, much less of a miraculous sign, to the extent of it being something they would complain about. So we want to see the signs in our life for what they are, signs from God, a witness to his action, his testimony, that he is there, and to not let them to be wearisome. So again, what are the signs or sign that there is a God and that he is working in your life? My grandma, she was quite hard of hearing, and so when she could hear the bird song, that was a real sign to her that there was a God and that he was close by. And so for each of us, there will be a different reason. And these reasons may change over the years. But regardless, we need to know that God is a part of our lives, day by day. And just if we can turn back to that Psalm 77. Some marvellous words there. Son of Asaph. And Asaph writes of a man that was struggling to know that God was in his life. And he asks the question in verse 7. Will the Lord cast off forever? Will he never again be pleased with us? That was his question. Verse 8. Has he stopped loving us? Does his promise no longer stand? Has God forgotten to be merciful? Has anger taken the place of his compassion? These were valid questions and queries that Asaph pondered and thought about, or this man at least thought about. Then I said verse 10, what hurts me most is that God is no longer powerful. And so perhaps in his life he saw that there was no action from God. But he says in verse 11, I will remember your great deeds, Lord. I will recall the wonders you did in the past. I will think about all that you have done. I will meditate on all your mighty acts. Everything you do, O God, is holy. No God is as great as you. You are the God who works miracles. You show your might among the nations. And of course, the psalm carries on, and we can relate some of those things to God's work with Israel in the wilderness. But of course, that verse 10 to 12 is the key to Asaph's problem or this man's problem. Oh, verse 11 to 12, sorry. I will remember your great deeds, Lord. I need to look back. I need to think about what you've done in the past, because there is my answer. You do have power. But you haven't forgotten to be merciful. But you haven't stopped loving us. in the end of that verse, you led your people, you led your people like a shepherd with Moses and Aaron in charge. So think about God in the past, in the past of your life, or very much so in the past of the scriptures, because there is your answer. God is at work. And so in our Exodus readings at present, we've come to Mount Sinai with the people of Israel. But I want for us to go some 10 to 11 months on from the time they're at Sinai to Numbers chapter 10 to be encouraged this morning. So Numbers chapter 10. And we find in verse 11 of Numbers 10, it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from off the tabernacle of testimony. So this is the first time in the year or so that they've been at Sinai that the cloud is on the move. The sign that Israel were to pack up camp and to move on. So the chapter in some detail gives us the order of the camp as they were to march, and you'll notice in verse 14 that they set them into standards of three tribes, and the first standard or first company was led by the children of Judah, and it gives that big list. But at the end of the chapter, what I'd like to look at particularly is this verse 33 to 36, and I'll just read that for us. So Israel departed from the mount of the Lord 3 days' journey, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them in the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was upon them by day when they went out of the camp. And it came to pass when the ark set forth that Moses said, "Rise up, Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee." And when it rested, Moses said, "Return, O Lord, unto the many thousands of Israel." And I want for us to consider that these words that Moses said were not specifically commanded by God. I think he recites them out of his own accord when they left the camp. So when the ark was placed up on the shoulders of the priests, Moses said, "Rise up, Lord, let your enemies be scattered." When the ark was set down, Moses again said, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands in Israel." So we're not told that God commanded this rallying call that Moses uttered here, but Moses saw the need to save in Israel. And of course the question is for us, what can we learn? "Rise up, Lord," Moses said. And certainly it wasn't that God needed directing. God knew the way forward. He travelled ahead. He sent his angel before Israel. So God knew exactly where they were going. But I think that for Israel's benefit, Moses said it. And of course, by extension, for ours too. We do need to ask God to go before us. He knows the best way. He knows the best route. And it's not necessarily the easiest route or the easiest way or the quickest way, but the best way that God knows. And so likewise, when a destination, the resting place for that day was found, Moses again called out to God, "Return, O Lord." And again, Moses didn't need to say that because the cloud was there above the camp again to show that they were to stop. But of course, the lesson for us, like Moses, is to invite God back into our lives, to come back into our homes, to call God back. And that could be a lesson that we could take. And I think there are some nice parallels to this story in Numbers chapter 10 to a couple of accounts in the gospel records. And I'd like first to begin with the crossing of the lake in Mark chapter 6. And so what we're looking for is a parallel to what Moses has been doing here, to invite God back in. So Mark chapter 6. We'll pick up the story in verse 44 to 48. And so this is just after the feeding of the 5,000. Verse 44. And they that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men. And straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he alone on the land. And he saw them toiling and rowing, for the wind was contrary to them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh to them walking upon the sea, and would have passed them by. And so Mark records in his account of the feeding of the 5,000, and of course all four Gospels record this occasion, he records something very specific for us to consider. So let's just think about the story that Jesus, of course, sends off the 12 by boat, while he himself goes to a mountain to pray. And so by now it's evening time, and the boat is in the middle of the lake, and Jesus is on the shore, of course, on the land in this mountain. In verse 48, he sees them toiling away, rowing hard to get to the other side. And of course, sails seem to have no use, the wind is the wrong way for their crossing. And yet they are persistent. Their effort carries on until the fourth watch of the night. And sometime in the hour, just before dawn, I imagine, Jesus goes to them walking on the water. Unusually, Mark records at the end of that verse, 48, that he would have passed by them. He would have just kept on walking right past. Why is this? Jesus knew that they'd been struggling. He'd been watching them. They'd been at the oars for maybe 6 hours or more. They did need help. But Jesus didn't come to them until we find what they say in verse 49. And the disciples, when they saw Jesus walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been the Spirit and cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them and saith unto them, be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And so perhaps here is our connection to Numbers in this account of Moses' call to God. The disciples needed to invite Jesus into the ship. For us too, we need to invite Jesus into our lives. He knew and he does know our situation, but he can't help unless he is called alongside or called to help. And it's this idea of the parakletos, isn't it? To call one alongside, and Jesus is just there, called alongside. His first words to them, of course, is, be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And so I think Moses in Numbers 10 has set a pattern for us in our discipleship. We believe God is all around us, he's in front of us wanting to lead, but we are each encouraged to call him to act in our lives, particularly when we're unsure of the journey, we're unsure of the direction that our lives are facing. And if so, we can ask, as Moses did, rise up, Lord. And when we're tired and need a rest, or we've completed a task or journey, likewise, Moses' call, or our call can be, return, O Lord, come back. But a second example that perhaps parallels Numbers chapter 10 is in Luke 24. And we'll know the story well because it's the account of the two on the road to Emmaus. So in Luke chapter 24, again we'll just pick up the little story in verse 13 to 16. The two travellers went that same day to a village called Emmaus, which was from Jerusalem about 70 furlongs, or about 7 miles. And they talked together all things which had happened, and it came to pass that while they communed together and reasoned, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were holden or veiled, so they could not, or they should not know him. And again, we just jump ahead to verse 20. The stranger we know is Jesus, and he wants to correct their confusion and sorrow about the crucifixion, to show that actually these things were supposed to happen, that men were to kill him, and that the Messiah, before he should come into glory, did need to die. So verse 20, the problem the two had is that they couldn't see the reason the chief priests and rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and have crucified him. We trusted it had been he which should have delivered Israel, redeemed Israel. And besides all this, today is the third day since these things were done. It's a hopeless situation. They couldn't see the reason for it, and they were dejected. And as I say, verse 26, Jesus, this traveller, explains to them from the scriptures, verse 26, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? And he began at Moses and all the prophets, and he opened the scriptures to them concerning himself. And so the two travellers carry on with this other man, the stranger, and they reach their destination at the village called Emmaus. And this stranger, who has such a good grasp of scripture, verse 28, made as though he would just keep on going. He would have gone further. But they persist in verse 29, and they constrain him, saying, "Abide with us. It's evening. The day's spent." And he went and tarried with them. Again, the point that Luke is making for us is that they, like we, need to call Jesus into the house at the end of the day. He'd been travelling with them, but he was going to keep on going further. And they invited him in. Jesus had been with the travellers and encouraged them to think about the scriptures, to think again about the scriptures, actually, that although he had been killed, he would rise again. And the outcome of inviting Jesus in at this stage was that he actually took over the evening meal. It was he who took their bread, notice. He took their bread, the meal that they had, and broke it, blessed it, and gave it to them. And of course, verse 30, it was at this point their eyes were open. Came to pass as he sat at meat with them, he took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them, and their eyes were opened, and they knew him. So, brothers and sisters, how apt it is that very shortly we soon will break bread, as Jesus has asked of each of us. We too desire that our eyes might be opened to the presence of Jesus in our lives. We want to invite him into our homes, that he might stay with us. So again, the question, what is it in your life that proves to you that God exists and he's at work with you? Israel just needed to open their tent door every morning to look out and to see the manna on the ground. They could step out of their tent and look up and see the pillar of cloud in the midst and know that God was among them. And we likewise are asked to believe the words of Matthew 28, verse 20. The closing words, you don't need to turn there. It says, Jesus says to the 12 or 11 at this stage, "And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. Amen." And so that was Jesus' encouragement to them as he left. I'm leaving, but I'm with you, even to the end of the world, the end of the age. And Jesus is here right now amongst us. He'll go with us as a traveller to encourage us, but we still need to keep continually inviting him into our lives.